welcome all to the Committee on Finance. We have a broad range of important issues to deal with this morning, and we, in addition to our regular work, also need to have a special meeting to be held concurrently with the regular meeting. So we need to call the roll for that. So I'll ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Okay, I'll be calling Committee on Finance members only. Regents Blum, Brewer, Dine, Garamendi, Wolf, Hopkinson, Island, Hosberg, Ward, Nunez, Farsky, Freud, Schwarzenegger, Walker, Faculty Representative Oakley, Staff Advisor Brewer, Staff Advisor Abrahams, and Chairman Yamaform.
Great. May I have a motion to waive service and notice for the special meeting? Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor? Opposed? Motion adopted, so the record can show the notice was waived. We also need to deal with the minutes of the meeting of May 17th. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? All those in favor? Aye. Opposed? Great. That's adopted. Now, what I'd like to do is to adjust the schedule a little bit at the request of Regent Blum. I'd like to take up RE89. We have a guest here, and so we're going to take this item up first. And so I will turn it over to Regent Blum. Thank you, Russ. I think there's one thing that we can all agree on when it comes to the issue of research and tobacco as far as the university is concerned, is that passions run high on every side of this issue. Some of us, I for one, who favored a ban on taking tobacco research money, have thought long and hard and listened very carefully to what the academic senate had to say on the issue, and they, and they'll speak for themselves, clearly opposed the ban based on academic freedom, slippery slope, and so forth. So I think a number of us, working with President Dines and others, are trying to shape some sort of compromise that is short of a complete ban and to something that both our respected colleagues in the Academic Senate and the President and his team can find acceptable. I think we're making good progress on this issue. We're not quite there yet. We'll hear more about that when other regents and President Dines make their comments. But I did ask Sharon Eubanks, who was kind enough to come out here from Washington, where the weather is much nicer than it is here, I'm sure. Sharon is a terrific lady. She served as deputy director and litigator of the Department of Justice for over 20 years, arguing more than 100 appeals on a wide range of issues, including the government's largest civil case ever filed, U.S. versus Philip Morris, a landmark case decided in favor of the United States last August. Before joining the Justice Department, Ms. Eubanks practiced antitrust law for the Federal Trade Commission. In 2003 and 2004, she served as an adjunct professor of law at George Washington University and now lives in Virginia. Sharon, thank you very much for coming to visit with us this morning.
People of the United States in the case United States versus Philip Morris, and as Chairman Blum has said, last August the court decided that case in favor of the United States. That was approximately 11 months ago. There was a favorable decision of the United States District Court, a federal district court, finding specific fraudulent conduct by by the industry that does continue until this day. I thank you today for the opportunity to address the policy being considered that would impose a ban on tobacco funding for university research. I'm addressing you from the perspective of a former law enforcement official in the executive branch of the United States government. Dean David Kessler and I sent a letter on March 29, 2007, which I believe is in the packet of information that you have. We sent this letter to Chairman Blum that addresses with some specificity the reasons that we believe that the university should support a ban. I refer you to that correspondence, given my limited time here to speak with you today. Today I want to address, I want to advocate that the University of California join other prominent institutions and ban tobacco industry funding for research. I urge this position based upon practical concerns, and I am armed with the decision of a United States federal judge with an independent member of our judicial branch. Frankly, it doesn't get any better than that in terms of support for taking a position. Query, why would the University of California permit university researchers to accept money from a group of racketeers who intentionally misled the public about the dangers of their product, all for the purposes of increasing the bottom line? Profit. Academic freedom, you say? Well, academic freedom, like any other freedom, comes with specific responsibilities. First, the policy imposed, if you look at it carefully, or even take a cursory analysis of it, that policy imposed would not infringe upon the right to pursue knowledge for its own sake and to follow wherever the search for truth may lead. Now, being someone who only taught in an institution a couple of courses at a law school as an adjunct professor, I thought maybe I didn't quite get this academic freedom thing. So I did a little research and I looked at some documents, and one of the things I came across was a report of the first global colloquium of university presidents. This took place in January of 2005, and it provided a definition of academic freedom that I think is apropos to the discussion here today. I'm reading from that document now, and it states, participants generally agree that the term academic freedom refers to the freedom for members of the academic community, teaching personnel, students, and researchers to pursue their scholarly activities within a framework determined by that community with respect for ethical rules and standards and without the threat of external interference. Considerations of ethics and the potential for external interference are front and center in any discussion or debate of academic freedom that involves the tobacco industry. The misconduct that the industry engaged in, indeed the ethics of the tobacco industry, has long been both alleged as well as documented. However, the determination by a neutral fact finder, a federal judge, who made her findings of conspiratorial conduct objectively, gives rise to more ammunition than anyone ever should need to focus in on these issues and to address a ban. It was a full and fair record during which the industry itself had more than adequate opportunity to present its case, its position. The trial in this matter lasted for 9 long months, although I can assure you it seemed like it was a lot longer there, and due process was served. At the end of that process, we had a decision providing compelling rationale for the regents to decline money from these companies. As the court found, tobacco companies furthered their illegal racketeering by creating organizations such as the Tobacco Industry Research Committee, later named CTR, which was a symbol, and this is a quote from the decision, a sophisticated public relations vehicle based on the premise of conducting independent scientific research to deny the harms of smoking and reassure the public. And the Center for Indoor Air Research, another organization, organization created by the industry, publicly billed as an independent scientific entity organized to support research projects addressing indoor air issues, but as its funding was controlled by the tobacco industry and its projects were sought for the purpose of establishing industry-favorable science and potential expert witnesses. One of the things that the court found in this case, in factual determinations on an objective setting, was that the industry went about using university research projects of individuals at universities to provide information that they wanted to use and enhance their ability in court to prevail by keeping a stable of researchers available to serve as expert witnesses and to support their positions. At the same time they used the universities, the court found, they did not themselves do independent research or do research in-house on matters that really would focus in on the question, most likely because they knew the answers. Tobacco, as I'm sure you know, is the only product that, when legal product is sold in this country, that when used is directed to kill the users. Now, the court found that the old organizations that were created simply have been morphed into newer organizations, and that the activities of the industry, that some of you may believe, were cured with the settlement agreement in with the states in the late 90s, that took care of everything? No. The court found just 11 months ago, and had to find in order for the United States to prevail on its racketeering claim, that those actions of the industry continue unto this day, and that the industry has morphed its research issues into other organizations and is using them for the same purposes that it utilized the organizations that was required to disband with the state settlement. The court found that they used their research to fund research attacks that attacked scientific studies that demonstrated harmful effects of smoking. But at the same time, the industry itself would not do its own research. It would not conduct research addressing the fundamental questions regarding the adverse health effects of smoking. Now, again, let me speak just a moment about academic freedom. There is positively nothing that would restrict the ability of any researcher to study and investigate fully and to publish all findings if this policy is adopted. Accepting funding from tobacco companies who have a history of distorting science and were found to have engaged in fraudulent conduct through their research activities is antithetical to the concept of academic freedom. Academic freedom, by whatever definition you may apply, must coexist with academic responsibility. The university has obligations, indeed it has a responsibility, to adopt a policy that protects health. Now, in response to those who do contend that the suppression of research results is not a problem because the university does not accept prior restraints on publications, I believe, with respect, that wholly misses the mark here. The controlling conduct of the industry over research funding, as the court found, was rarely placed in writing and almost never was openly agreed upon. It became a practice of how they conducted themselves when they served in their enterprise of illegal activities. Because of this, its influence is nearly impossible to detect and to avoid by applying standard university policies. It is important to emphasize that nothing in this proposed policy would in any way restrict the subject or the content of research, even the faculty and others advocating pro-tobacco industry positions. That is important. Everyone would still be able to do whatever research they wanted to. Now that is academic freedom. What it does, however, is it ensures that adopting such positions is not financed by the tobacco industry. Now, by declining money from the tobacco industry, the regents would protect the reputation and the integrity of the university by ensuring not even being the parents at the University of California faculty who advocate pro-tobacco positions are doing so because of the tobacco industry funding. Now, there have been concerns raised about relying upon a decision that may go up on appeal. With respect, that's just a web factor. The fact is that these are factual findings, which the lawyers in the room know, in terms of overturning factual findings of a court after a 9-month trial where the court has observed the witnesses and made credibility findings based upon their demeanor, that those findings would have to be determined to be clearly erroneous. That the Supreme Court has stated in numerous decisions that findings of fact based upon credibility considerations are virtually unreviewable. And most important of all, the industry has had an opportunity to announce to the Court of Appeals what issues it will appeal, and it hasn't said that it will seek to overturn the factual findings, and there were 4,000 pages of factual findings in the court's decision on any of the matters that are relevant to research funds and to the research activities of the company. Now, in Judge Kessler's opinion of 1,653 pages, which is being appealed, as I said, there just isn't anything that focuses upon the issues that are before you. There are legal challenges to whether the court erred by considering certain arguments that the United States raised and so forth and so on, but those factual findings are still out there. Furthermore, you simply don't even need those factual findings. Yeah, as Dorothy was told in The Wizard of Oz, you had the answer before you all along. The documents from the industry are housed at the University of California. The court used the very documents that the university itself possesses in its archives and its records are documents upon which the court relies to make its decision. I can assure you that these records themselves make conclusions that are no different from many of those that the court has labeled as factual findings. So you have the documents, you don't really need the judicial imprimatur, but it certainly does help to have that. And again, the likelihood of it being overturned on appeal is something that seems to be a very slender consideration, something that you ought not place any thought on. Now I want to turn to the slippery slope argument. In law school, we are always hearing about the slippery slope, so this is one that I'm completely familiar with. In this case, those who talk about the slippery slope and urge a different result, I would say that that's really more akin to fear-mongering. Because you're saying, what next? Well, let's look at the industry that we're talking about and not worry about other industries for a moment. Tobacco is doing it again. What other industry has been judicially determined to be racketeers? There is a direct nexus here between singling out the tobacco industry on the basis of its conduct that does not affect other industries under these circumstances. Note here that we are talking about an enterprise where competitors came together to work in an enterprise of racketeering, to engage in illegal activities altogether. I've heard members of the faculty talk about, well, there are other industries out there that we think are equally, if you will, evil. I'm not saying that there aren't a number of industries or companies who have engaged in this conduct, but I am telling you, without question, there isn't another that meets the standards of being called racketeers and that has been found to coordinate its activities as these defendants have, and moreover, that they continue to do this to this day. The reform movement that you see in the commercials that they put on television and on their website is not what really is happening. That's them saying what they had to say. I can assure you, they said all of those things to the independent federal judge as well. And on the record that she had before her, she did not find that it was no longer a concern.
Oh.
There simply is no other industry that has engaged or is engaging as a group in such lawlessness, which is a coordinated practice here. So the region should certainly address that fact as well. When competitors engage, as they have here, it's something specific to look at. So as a regional enterprise, the conduct of the tobacco industry stands alone important to your consideration here, and it's something that is often called in Washington the optics. I mean, to be blunt, I would urge you not to allow some distorted notion of academic freedom to hijack the university's reputation and its ethical standards. Why do business with faculties? Ask yourself. Why do business with faculties? Without the adoption of a policy prohibiting certain tobacco company funding, partnership, that's right, you heard right, partnership with the tobacco industry through the grant process is inevitable. By accepting research funds at this stage, the university gives the tobacco industry undeserved respectability and legitimacy by association. The university becomes a de facto partner with the industry. Such an apparent partnership needlessly endangers the status and the reputation of this fine university. This is, as I said at the outset, an ethical issue. The question of adoption of the policy proposed is not a dilemma for the university. Rather, it is an opportunity. Many times, because the failure to recognize ethical problems, important ethical considerations are dismissed or ignored. So this is certainly an opportunity. To be sure, there is a lot of money that will be coming the university's way for research as other prominent universities see the light and prohibit such funding. Like it or not, the University of California, without a policy, will become the poster child for tobacco research. If that's all right with you, and if that's what you want, if you want to be identified as supportive of this industry that kills over 440,000 Americans every year, then certainly that's your prerogative. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and on a personal note, I'd like to tell you that I am passionate about these issues, but they certainly have not done anything to enhance my career or to move things on. I'm passionate about them because I myself have reviewed the factual underpinnings of these arguments, and like the judge, I believe, I know, that this is not an industry that deserves your support. Thank you very much.